and Chris, and this is my Writing Table podcast, where we talk to authors and other creatives about the writing world and what it takes to create the books that we love to read. Ready? Pull up a chair and let's begin. Jen Phillips has written 6 novels, and her work has been sold in 29 countries. Jen's debut novel, The Well in the Mine, won the 2009 Barnes & Noble Discover Award. The Los Angeles Times called it an astonishing debut and noted that a whisper runs through the novel, the ghost of places and people, and luscious peach pies, making it a combination of dream and nightmare, nightmare and dream. Her novel, Fierce Kingdom, was named one of the best crime novels of 2017 by New York Times Book Review. It was also named one of the best books of the year by NPR, Publishers Weekly, Amazon, and Kirkus Reviews. A Kirkus-starred review called it poignant and profound, adding that this adrenaline-fueled thriller will shatter readers like a bullet through bone. The New York Times called the novel expertly made, clever, and irresistible, noting that Phillips beautifully captures the quirks, tedium, and magic of parenting a young child. Jen's novels have also been named as selections for Indie Next, Book of the Month, and the Junior Library Guild. Born in Montgomery, Alabama, Jen graduated from Birmingham Southern College with a degree in political journalism. After time spent in Ireland, New York, and Washington, D.C., she currently lives with her family, plus a schnoodle and a mini golden mountain doodle in Birmingham. Welcome, Jen.
Thanks so much, Chris. I'm glad to be here.
I've been looking at all the novels you've written, and you have written far more than I thought you had, because you had some middle grade novels as well.
That's right.
You have 2 middle grade books, and then you also have several adult novels. Are you still writing in both genres?
You know, I haven't done middle grade or YA in a while. For all writers, there are these gaps when your manuscript's being read, and one of the kids' books was a nice sort of gap to do something really different, to kind of use a different part of my brain. And I have not done another one in the last couple of years, although I like the idea. I keep feeling like some idea will come to me.
You've been able to keep your hand in both if you want to.
Yeah, especially if you've had sort of a research-heavy novel, something complex and that's really sort of taken everything out of you. You know, I think for most people, when they think back to childhood reading, at least most people who become writers, those are the days you think of when reading was just pure joy and you didn't really think about theme or character motivation. You didn't do any underlining. You just sort of sat in your bed and tried to stay up later than your parents wanted you to. And it's nice to write for that age. I did enjoy reconnecting to those days for myself of when reading was just pure addictive pleasure, which it can still be, but it is, I maybe don't hit the pure addictive pleasure quite as often these days as when I was 10.
Understandable. Another one of yours features a foreword by Fanny Flagg. On your website, there were pictures of family linked to it. Can you tell us about The Well in the Mine?
Sure. So The Well in the Mine was my first novel. I had met Fanny Flagg earlier when I was in college briefly. And the dean of our college also knew her. So the whole first novel process of trying to get people to read it, even once it's been published. My publishers were in Oregon. I was published first with a small press before Penguin or Riverhead picked up that book. So they were very keen on getting a good introduction. And I think largely because they were in Oregon, I live in Alabama. First, they called and said, "We have thought of who should do the introduction for your book." And I was like, "Great, who?" And they said, "Harper Lee, do you know her?" I'm like, "No, I don't actually. We don't like run into each other at the bar. I mean, I feel like there's maybe more people in Alabama than you think there are." So once they adjusted to the fact that I probably could not single-handedly make Harper Lee happen, then we started discussing other possibilities. And Fanny Flagg came up and I reached out and she was very gracious. So that is the introduction there. I don't know how much she remembered meeting me, but she was nice enough to say that she did. And she wrote a very nice introduction to the book. But yes, the other part of your question, I had been playing around with another manuscript since college that never got published. That was sort of a self-taught class on how to write or not to write a novel. When I started The Well in the Mine, the story came to me in part because the world was so familiar. I thought about the place, which is a small coal mining town in North Alabama, is set where my grandmother and her siblings grew up. The place, in terms of the house itself, is modeled on the house that they grew up in and that I grew up still visiting. And then the characters themselves, the plot itself is completely fabricated. It is fiction. But a lot of the details, a lot of the world building comes from family stories. The characters themselves, I think, have a lot of, I always say it's sort of a backbone of a real person that, although they are fictional versions, it's got a family with two girls, a boy, and a mom and dad. And one of the sisters, Virgie, has my grandmother's sense of propriety. Her sort of bone structure there is that every action is judged based on what if somebody saw you doing it? And then everything else comes out of there. That's not all she is, but that was sort of the core of her. And so each one of those characters in that book, I feel like, has some real life spark that led to them. It's in some ways the most personal book I've written, but certainly in terms of family history and a sense of place.
As an author, you hear in terms of craft about the sense of place, of setting being its own character.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like that is definitely a book that the setting was a character.
I think probably especially for a first novel that it was helpful to have something that resonated so deeply personally. My next novel was set in New Mexico, where I'd never set foot before I started doing the research. And it dealt with archaeology, which I knew nothing about. And so that was fun and exciting in a different immersive way. But for a first book, you know, to still be trying to convince myself that I could actually write a book and that someone might want to publish it, I think to set a story in a world where I really knew the textures. Now, it's also set in 1931. So some of those textures I didn't know. In terms of just the feel of the floorboards under your feet, or the smell of the apple trees, or the sound of the creek in the distance, you know, it was helpful, I think, to know those things without having to research them and to be able to hear the sounds or smell the smells while I was sitting at my desk without having to go anywhere.
Oh, sure. That authenticity right there. And you're just almost transcribing it. Your latest book is Family Law. What can you tell us about it?
I'll back up slightly to say, although it's very different, it is in some ways a response to the book before it, my own response. The book before this one was called Fierce Kingdom, and it deals really closely with motherhood, in particular with a mother and her 4-year-old son in a zoo. Although it is a book that's pretty tense and thrillery and deals with a public shooting, I thought of it first and foremost as a book about motherhood, what we owe our children, what we owe other people's children. Building from that, even as I was traveling around talking about Fierce Kingdom, especially when I'd go in places, went back home and looked out and saw maybe teachers from grade school, from high school, women I'd known my whole life, then it really occurred to me that for me, motherhood had a broader definition. There are a lot of women who reached out, women I wasn't related to, who I was close to and who really showed me some alternate paths. You know, I think maybe some of us grow up to be exactly who our parents think we will be. I think for most of us, there's a gap there. And I found that gap interesting of how you choose who you want to be, which self you want to be. So Family Law is at its heart, I think, a book about the ways women shape each other and how we choose ourselves. It is set in the late 70s and early 80s in Montgomery, Alabama, and follows an early woman lawyer at a time when a woman in the courtroom was very rare. And then her friendship with a teenage girl is sort of the crux of the story of what happens between them, and particularly when the lawyer's work becomes dangerous and threatens both of them, how that changes both their lives.
Like you said, it's set in the 70s and 80s, but the themes seem to be pretty evergreen. Women in any career, but this character's facing a career in the South. How did you approach the research and the background work for this novel?
First of all, I think you're right. Unfortunately, a lot of the same issues very much seem like they're still there in terms of career and family, in terms of women being able to move upward in their careers and getting a seat at the table. That said, in some ways, this book was encouraging in the time period I'm talking about, when I talked to women who were working in that time, and one lawyer in particular who I'll mention in a minute. Lucia in the book is one of two women in her law school class in the early 70s, and that was true and accurate down here. You would have seen some different numbers in the Northeast, but in the South, certainly, it was extremely rare to see a woman lawyer, even rarer to see a woman judge. And so there is at least some advantage now to whatever issues there still are in terms of what happens once women have families and ways we can make that easier to balance. Nonetheless, in terms of a seat at the table, to have no women or next to no women in law school versus half of a law school class made up of women, you know, whatever the issues still are, it is certainly a difference, and it is certainly a step in the right direction. So that's my little bid for like some level of hope in the midst of so many things that are telling us to give in to like doom and frustration. But in terms of research, in some ways, back to textures, this is the only book I've written set in the time and place of my childhood. I grew up in Montgomery. So in some ways, that world was very familiar, in particular, the world for Rachel, who's a teenager. My family was very like her family, which is pretty conservative in every definition of the word. The law part, I knew nothing about, even though I feel like everybody who is an English major, which I was, has been told you should be a lawyer. But that's just like the natural path people think if you would like a paycheck and you would also like to do something with words. But I never wanted to be a lawyer. It sounded terrible, frankly. So I didn't know anything about it. But I had years ago, at this point, maybe 12, 15 years ago, interviewed a lawyer in Birmingham, a family lawyer. And she had told me these stories about her early days in law, which I remembered, and I'd always thought maybe I could do something with that. And for this book, when I really wanted to sort of deal with a particular culture and a girl raised in a particular culture and sort of what else she might see as a possibility, and thought, who would show her the possibilities? What if it's someone like that? What if that background, someone who was involved in fighting for the ERA and had gone to law school and was just so sort of far left of where most women in Montgomery, Alabama would have been, who was sort of an avowed feminist, just not a word that you would have heard thrown around a whole lot in sort of suburban Alabama in the 70s or 80s or now. I really liked that idea. And so I went back to her, and she shared a lot of her own experiences. And I will tell you, one nice thing about doing research with lawyers is they are great proofreaders. Anytime I have a source, I would show them what I'm writing and be sure that they're judging it for, you know, did I get this right or screw this up, especially if it's something like archaeology. She would like fix commas and go through, do like way above the pay grade for checking anything she could, and going through, you know, courtroom dialogue and trying to make it more accurate for what she thought people would really say. So that was nice. I always feel like one secret to a book that works is, if you are stupid about something, just find someone smart enough who will talk to you and fake your way through it by stealing all their smart things.
We get critiqued on our writing or the subjects we choose or the way we build these characters. That's something we can control, is getting it factual.
Getting it right.
Realistic. Yeah. It's kind of funny when you said that about growing up and the word feminism. I grew up in the Texas Panhandle, and I do remember the word feminism coming up in the 70s and 80s, and it was not used in a very kind way.
Right.
No, and it was not. And wow, now I think back, I hadn't thought about that till you said that.
No, I think I remember reading in high school an essay by Linda Ellerbe and maybe Good Housekeeping, one of those magazines that all the moms had in the houses. And it was about the definition of feminism and said, basically, it means women are equal to men. And I read it probably four times and like the whole thing, and really, and was really stunned by like, wait, that's what it means. Because the tone I have been hearing definitely implied something worse than that. But yeah, I don't think everyone grows up in a bubble. But when you do, it's really hard to even realize it's a bubble And until, mm-hmm. yeah, you leave and go to college or move away somewhere and like, but that's 18 years to be trapped in a certain set of thoughts and opinions and worldviews without realizing there might be more out there.
We can all get stuck in our little echo chambers so easily, and you don't realize how easy that is until you step out of it. And then you're like, wow, other attitudes and right. opinions that are not bad. They're just different.
Right. That are just different. And I think, yeah, especially as a kid, and I think it takes a while for most kids to realize whatever your family is like, that it's not the only way, and to start going to sleepovers or trips and start to realize like, wait, even that sense that sort of what my parents say is not what all parents say. And that yeah. the way they are is not what all parents are. You know, there's sort of levels to that as you break through and start to just realize that, yes, there is more out there.
Younger character and that more seasoned character to mentor her. And how lucky would we all be to have had a person like that?
I had women, particularly teachers, who played that role and probably play that role for a lot of people, and maybe especially for girls. I think teachers were the first people, more so than women in my family, who actually acted like asking questions could be good as opposed to problematic.
You don't have to just sit there and be pretty.
Right. So you can talk, and that's okay. If what you're saying is reasonable, go ahead and talk.
You chose to write this in dual POV. Some people will do one draft in one character, and then they'll write the other character in a completely different draft and then combine them. Some will do it along the way. How and why did you do it that way?
I believe everything I've written, certainly all the everything other than the middle grade books, has been alternate point of view, some more points of view than others. And I've always done them within the same manuscript. I may go back and add something. In this case, it is just going back and forth between Lucia and Rachel. And there might be times where I would know Lucia's next part and not be quite sure what was happening to Rachel, where I might skip forward. I don't always write chronologically in any manuscript. But yet, what's happening with Lucia is going to inform what's happening with Rachel and vice versa. And so I do think by having them in the same manuscript, I like to see them laid out side by side and be able to mm-hmm. notice the overlaps or the themes or even just the details of setting or language that might be popping up. I can see if it were really complex, a whodunit or something where they really were more separate, that might mm-hmm. be helpful to write them separately. But for this one, there is a lot of overlap between the two sections anyway, where they are in each other's sections and we're seeing them through each other's eyes. So yeah, for me, it's always in the same manuscript.
How long does it take you to write your original rough draft manuscript?
I'm sure like everyone, the amount of time to write that first draft fluctuates, but normally reasonably fast, 8 months to a year, sometimes 5 or 6 months. And then some of those come very quickly. Fierce Kingdom, I wrote the first draft in 5 or 6 months. I had it off to my agent within a year, and it was sold probably 14 months from when I wrote the first page. Sometimes you get the core of the story the first time. Sometimes you see that and you don't have to do a whole lot of paring down and sculpting. Sometimes you get it wrong and you wind up with a whole bunch of extraneous stuff. And then that is a longer manuscript. First drafts usually come quickly, but then what might happen is instead realizing in the second draft, I got that a little wrong. Like that's not, unfortunately, the story seems to mainly be in this 50 pages and the rest of it is not really crucial. Either way it works, I like to get that first draft down and then step back from it and maybe see it a little more clearly than I saw it when it was in my head.
As hard as it is for us to walk away from those manuscripts, it sure fixes a lot just that time.
No, I always think if there's a problem with a sentence, then I need to be staring at my screen. If there's a big picture problem, I've got to get away from the screen. That is rarely when the answer comes. And that often I need to just try to not even think about it and wait for something to float up.
That takes discipline to do that.
Right.
We know that works, but why is that so hard for us to say, park it, we're not going to think about this right now?
My theory is I used to think that I was unusual to be a pretty type A personality and very deadline centered and like to-do list centered and to be a writer. And while that may be true in terms of like writers in general, in terms of successful novelists, everybody seems to be me. I don't think you get books published unless you are driven and disciplined and good at deadlines. But I kind of think that might be the problem, that because you love deadlines and efficiency and like, let me get this done, it doesn't feel efficient to put your manuscript down for a month. That seems exactly like the opposite of efficiency. So I do feel like you do this, and so much of what you learn is, I've got to stay on top of things. I can't wander around in my pajamas. I can't be drifting off and watching TV. Like, I need to write. And so it really goes against what you've drilled into yourself all those months and years to instead purposefully not write and count that as work as well. But yes, it is crucial. Maybe half the job is actually not in front of the computer, but instead just puzzling it through, or actively trying to not puzzle it through and letting it puzzle itself through.
One of the things writing has taught me is how powerful our subconscious is. Like, people go, where did you get that idea? And I'm sure they ask you, where did you get that idea? And you're like, hell if I know. I mean, you can
make up an answer after the fact often. Like, I can tell you something that makes logical sense.
Well, what does your writing day look like?
Well, let's see. I mean, once upon a time, and in some ways still like in an ideal world, I mostly wrote at night. Certainly for that first book, I was freelancing and doing things that paid the bills during the day. And then after dinner, I would decide I would spend at least an hour in front of the manuscript. And usually it went longer than that. Like, I think most of that book was written after 10 p.m. and some on weekends. And I still love, theoretically, the late hours of the evening when the rest of the house is asleep and no one can call and no one can email. And it's so peaceful and magical. However, since having a child, he's 11, it's not like I've just had a child. My brain doesn't work that well at night anymore. And so I occasionally will get some good time late, but mostly I write like a boring, normal person in any job, and something like 8 to 3, and I pick up my child from school at 3, and I might get another hour or two in the afternoon. If I'm really into a book those last few weeks, as I can feel it coming together, then it's a little more free form and I might stay up late and carve out whatever time I can. But it's a very regimented sort of typical work day.
Have you found time to read lately?
Oh my gosh. Well, I really love Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, Gabrielle Zevin. And I'm still in a little bit of a book hangover from that, of how much I loved that one. This is always the question that's like, I can't think of any books. I can't think of any authors. I'm pretty confident I've never read a book at all. They always completely fly out of my head. I also just finished Singer Distance by Ethan Chittagnier. You know, I have no idea if I'm saying his last name correct. It's about sort of an alternate history, as if we had been communicating with Mars since the 1960s. Really brilliant. And it's about sort of, on one hand, is about math and space and a new language, but is also about grief and longing and trying to connect with people who are gone or people who are still here. It's like a really impressive mix of intellect and gut.
The description reminds me of Cloud Cuckoo Land.
Oh, yes, which I really, really like. Cloud Cuckoo Land is one that, it was a slow build for me.
Yes.
But, and I stuck with it. The payoff was so tremendous. Thought the first few hundred pages were a little,
but it all makes sense when you get far enough into it, you understand. And I had read All the Light We Cannot See. Mm-hmm. So those two are so different.
They're so different. No, it's amazing range.
Man is a genius, though. I mean, how do you plot like that? Smoke and mirrors plotting. I don't know how his agent looks at that and says, okay, yeah, go on, finish that up.
The outline must be, there's just got to be a substantial outline. But yes, that's one that I think about still, that really stuck. The ending of everything and sort of the overall power of it was really like just lodged deeply and is apparently going to be there permanently.
What is the most fun part of writing for you?
Honestly, I like almost all the parts of writing. I'm always baffled when people complain about it and feel like they should go tar a roof or work at McDonald's or something, because the idea that somebody pays me to make things up is perpetually crazy. But really, ultimate favorite part, probably still the blank page. I love it. I love starting something new. I don't ever find it daunting. I love it before you've screwed anything up, before you've made your choices, when everything is still a possibility and just those first few words and the start of it all is thrilling. There's no adrenaline rush in the rest of the process that's quite like that for me.
Yet I go back to that first page a million times throughout the course of the book. Today I was driving, I was like, something hit me. It's like, oh, that would be good on that first line. You know, I changed the first line. I should keep a document of all the first lines for each book, because I'll bet you there are 50 to 100.
Now, surely everyone edits that first page more than any other page. And I'm sure I edit page 10 more than page 20, but just, I'm going to go back and read the beginning more often than anything else, which makes sense because that's the part you got to sell. If somebody's bored five pages in, who knows if they'll keep going.
Well, I think it also reinforces to the reader that they're getting what you're selling them. You know, they open that first page, go, okay, I'll buy this book.
Right.
But then 50 pages, 100 pages in, they're like, oh, this has nothing to do with that. I'm lost. You know, it kind of reinforces, let's keep a consistent theme, consistent voice. What is your advice for new writers?
Inspiration is highly overrated. Writing is like almost any other job in that you sit down and you do it, whether you feel like it or not, whether you're tired or not, get a cup of coffee or tea if you have to, and sit down and start. And I think you accept that sometimes it's not going to be great. And sometimes you might spend hours and get one great sentence. Sometimes you're going to have a great 30 minutes and knock out a couple of pages. But regardless, nothing happens if you don't sit down and write. And so the idea of the story or the notion of it doesn't really have that much to do with creating pages. Those aren't an idea. The pages come about because you sat down and gutted it out. Yes, I'm a big believer in you. Maybe you can't write every day, but I do think you've got to carve out time to make yourself sit down and accept that sometimes that's not pleasant and there's no fairy dust that makes it transcendent. Sometimes it feels like a job. And sometimes it's fantastic, but you never know which one of those days it's going to be until you sit down and make yourself start typing.
Thank you, Jen. That's advice that I needed to hear today.
Frankly, it does me good to say it as well. It's inspiration's nice. I wouldn't turn it down.
To learn more, visit jenphillips.com. If you're enjoying The Writing Table, please consider leaving us a review. There are so many podcasts out there. Reviews help other listeners find us. Thanks so much for your support.